Well, I'm honored to be with you, and it has been multiple times on campuses and by Zoom or whatever, Skype, with the education folks and so on. And I admire the commitment of Wesleyans to higher education, to helping your fellow believers think through what these basic theological views mean for your life in the world. And that's so important. I think if all people have is what they get from a sermon, that's not really enough to help us navigate our way through life. So it's so important to have Christian higher education. I'm really glad to be in some ways part of the Wesleyan tradition. Although I'm actually a Calvinist, so don't take that against me. So, I wrote out some notes for my talk, and I realized later that they're pretty small. I learned that, I think, from my father, who used to write commentary on the Bible in between the lines. And then the rest of us had to use a magnifying glass to see how it worked. So what I'm going to talk about with you is a so-called fairness for all proposal. And that is shocking to some people that morally and theologically conservative Christians would say there's this huge conflict in our society between religious freedom and gay rights. We want to solve that by working together to put into federal law protections both for religious freedom and for gay rights at the same time. So I want to talk about why we're thinking about that, where that came from, some of the ideas that are involved, and so on. But I would like to do that by starting with Martin Luther. But before I do that, just wanted to say, I'm going to be talking about public policy. Public policy is not theology. It's prudential. It's like our best assessment of what to do. It's not the red letter Bible. It's not in the Ten Commandments. So anything like Fairness for All or other proposals, they are an effort by people who are trying to take the faith seriously, the nature of God seriously, what we're called to do in the world seriously, what our time in history is, and then figure out the best way to proceed. So that's all it is. But I'm going to try to make a case for why I think Fairness for All is a good way to go forward. And I take it that not everybody is going to agree with that. That's fine. It's good to put ideas out there and to think about them. But like I said, I want to start. I guess I shouldn't put my paper down on my. Let that settle down. Here we go. I'll hold it. But as I said, I wanted to start with Martin Luther. So, you know that 2017 was the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. So as we count that, so that's when Luther did or didn't nail 95 theses on Wittenberg church door and started off this big revolt against the Roman Catholic Church and against the Holy Roman Empire, in which there had been this unity between Catholicism and political power. And when Luther came along and said, no, I don't agree with Catholicism, and you can't force me to do it, and then said, you have to break those two things apart. It's not right for the government to force us all to be Catholics when we think God has led us to some other place. That's kind of like the Protestant Reformation led to all these different denominations and so on. But, you know, that was a step for religious freedom, right? So people who believed in other views had a chance to worship and live out their lives and teach philosophy, have different kinds of universities and so on that weren't Catholic because they didn't believe that anymore. But you know what the reformers did was establish their own kind of required belief in the societies that they took over. And so it turned out that in parts of Germany, Lutherans wouldn't let Catholics worship anymore. Not in our country. We know what the truth is. It's not Catholicism, it's Lutheranism. So if you're going to be in our country, you got to do it Luther way. Calvin who had a big ministry in Geneva, said, now we know better what the Bible says, and it's certainly not Catholicism or Lutheranism or Mennonite beliefs. It's not even those other Reformed people. So if you're going to be in a church in Geneva, you're going to do it our way. And that's not even counting what happened to poor Michael Servetus. So people said, great, we broke away from Catholicism and then established their own kind of required faith. And it took centuries for Christians to discover that was a big mistake. And why is it a big mistake? Partly because you can't trust government to tell you what you ought to believe. Government's got a lot of other reasons to do things, and they're usually not to follow the gospel. And if it's a democracy, they've got to respond to everybody and then figure out something that's good for everybody. That's also not the gospel the way you would teach it in church. So it took people a long time to discover that it was wrong to let the government tell you what orthodoxy was and the way everybody had to believe and live. And there was a lot of violence involved in that process of learning that, unfortunately. We had to learn it in the United States. People came over, fled persecution, came to the United States, and then set up colonies that essentially persecuted other kinds of believers. And then we had to learn that religious freedom is actually an important good, because the way we interpret what God wants differs, and that's something that the churches should help us learn, and we can't entrust it to government to be the organization that tells us how to believe and how to live. My own background, Calvinists, they discovered, you know, in the first place, that if you let the French king tell you the way to believe, it ended up in the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, in which thousands of Calvinists were killed in France. A lot of them fled to Geneva, and then some of them got persecuted in Geneva because they had the wrong flavor of Calvinism. So to learn how to get past that the government's not going to be your church, took a lot of work. There has to be a different way to deal politically with our differences than to let the government decide what you all have to believe. All right, so I think that's worth thinking about when we think about where we are here in the United States. You know, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, we could say that Judeo-Christian ethics, views of human nature, relationships, all those kinds of things, there was some kind of a consensus. You remember there was an organization that was called Moral Majority, trying to draw people together. Who thinks that Christians are in the moral majority today? Not so much. It raises a real question of what to do. What do we do in a situation in which the views that we think are right, not just for ourselves, but for everybody, aren't the views that most people think are right for them? To me, that's a little bit like the challenge that faced people after the Reformation. What do we do when not everybody agrees on Catholicism, Calvinism, Wesleyanism, or something else? What do we do in our society when not everybody agrees on moral truth about relationships, human sexuality, even things like your own sexual identity, in which there's so much disagreement? We would like, I think, for the law to uphold what we are sure is true, because it's not just true for us, but it's true for everybody, and it's good for everybody. And we would love for the law to encode our values. But a lot of people out there are insisting that the law can't do that. It's oppressive to them. But then we say, well, if it's not going to encode our values, then at least let's not let the law force us to follow your values. Right? And I think that's kind of the point we're at the moment. So the law is not going to enforce Christian values. Whose values is it going to enforce? Or is there something other than having it enforce one group's values? So, put up this curmudgeonly figure, Abraham Kuyper. Some of you have heard that name. Abraham de Havelange Abraham the Terrible, you can also translate that Abraham the Powerful. You can guess that the critics called him terrible and the fans called him powerful. 19th century church leader, theologian, writer of devotionals, Christian school organizer, founded a Christian university in the Netherlands, political party, was a member of parliament, was a prime minister for a while. So, hugely influential Christian figure. But he discovered as he was going through his life that the things he thought were so true and right were not shared in his society, raising the question of what do we do? So he said in 1887, this is very loose, he said, "We no longer live in the golden age of heroic Dutch Calvinism. Now, secularism is a stamp of our age. You look around in public life, secularism is what people want to live by. If so, then," he said, "the Lord must have provided the means by which believers can witness faithfully to him, even in this time when we don't hold the reins of power and our views aren't shaping the way public life goes." Isn't that interesting? So I think that's kind of the question for us. What do we do in this time when not only are our beliefs not shared by many people, they don't consider themselves Christian, not even religious in many cases, but our moral sense of what's right and wrong is not shared by everybody. What do we do in a situation like that? And is there something that God would lead us to do in these circumstances? I think that's the kind of challenge that we face. And let me just back up. And he said, we shouldn't be pessimists when this happens, but we should see what kind of strategy we can have to continue to be faithful to God in the midst of people who want to go in other directions. And that's, I think, the challenge that we want to meet as well. Not to be defeatists, but how in a new time do we go forward to live by our convictions, even though others don't share them? So, some of you have seen this phrase. So this is the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, the former chairperson, talking about something we think is fundamental and vital, and he said it's just a mask for evil things. That's the kind of society that we live in increasingly. Conservative sexual morality is not seen as, for many people, another option, much less something that God created that's good for people, but as something that's wrong that some people are trying to force on other people, and they want to get out from under it. And some of them say, if you don't celebrate with us our liberation, then we've got to find a way to crush you, because we can't trust that you will protect us if you have these other views in opposition to us. And so I see this in Washington all the time. Are you a conservative Christian? Are you an evangelical? Well, then, of course, I know what you think about me, right? You would like to shut me up, put me in the corner, put me back in the closet, because you want to dominate, because that's what religious freedom is all about. You get to write the rules. So that's the situation I think we're in. And it's in that context that this idea of fairness for all comes. And it's often thought about as just kind of to deal with this conflict between LGBT rights and religious freedom. I think if you go a little deeper, you can see people who just want to be free to follow the Bible. We want to live faithfully. And people, we'd say on the other side, who just say we don't want to suffer discrimination for who we are, what we think we are. Or, on the one side, people who say you need to protect sexual equality, and on the other side saying, but we want to live by biblical limits. So what do we do with this big conflict in our society? Is there a way to deal with this conflict? In Utah in 2015, some of you know, the LDS Church and Equality Utah, which is the gay group, came together and said, we're going to put into Utah state law new protections for gay people and for religious people at the same time. And they did that. Of course, Utah is unique because of the role of the LDS Church, and it's a smaller population and so on. But that gave some of us an idea. So we're sitting in Washington with these pitched battles between people who want to stand for religious freedom, for the right that we need to have to live by biblical values, and other people are saying, we can't give you the room to do that, or you're going to crush us. And that's not a good battle to just let keep on going. So some of us met actually in the summer of 2015 and said, is there some other way to go forward? Maybe there isn't, but maybe there is. And I will say, when I looked at the two sides, I didn't see any reason to think there's any way to go forward, because when you're in a pitched battle, everybody's thinking about how much the other side's trying to attack you and how resolute you have to be to stand up against them. And they're thinking the same thing about you. And nobody's thinking about, is there any way that we might actually possibly live together in some fashion, right? You're just kind of thinking about, how do you protect yourself in this dangerous environment in which, if we let you get too much power, you're going to roll over our Wesleyan universities, and they feel like, but if we give you too much power, you're going to force us back in the closet and get rid of same-sex marriage and force us to live a sexual life that we don't just believe. And so it just seemed not very possible to think about actually even just talking together, making sense, saying maybe there's a couple of areas of law where there is a way to do something together. So we decided that we had to take a step of faith and say, maybe it's possible, maybe we should approach some groups on the other side and see if somebody wants to talk, and is there any place where we could agree on certain things. Now, as Christians, we ought to just stand for the truth, end of story, and it doesn't matter if somebody wants to talk and help protect us or not. But if it's possible to get people who think they're your opponents to still say, well, but we agree, if you do these things, that's fine with us. Isn't that a better place to be? So we thought we ought to move forward. And we, like I said, we started that back in 2015. Now, since 2015, a lot of things have happened. We've got a president who has a very different view about religious freedom. We have some new Supreme Court justices. That's encouraging to us. We also have a new House of Representatives. Not so encouraging to us. While these debates have been going on, not going on at the national level, states have been putting in same-sex marriage protections that often don't protect religious freedom in many parts around the country. Many municipalities have been doing this. And there are states like Michigan and Pennsylvania now in which the Human Rights Commission, without the legislature even having a say, deciding that when their laws say no sex discrimination, that also means no sexual orientation discrimination and no gender identity discrimination, without ever thinking about what the consequences of that might be for Wesleyan schools or anything else. So we live in a kind of a wild time in which we might have a pause at the moment, but I think if you think over time, it just seems like the pressure to put into federal law protections for gay people are going to be stronger and stronger. So what do we do about that? So one strategy is the fairness for all. That's to say, sit down with gay advocates who claim to believe in religious freedom and the First Amendment and see if we can agree on some protections for everybody. There are two other strategies in Washington. One of them is called Equality Act. Have you heard about that? Yeah. So Equality Act basically would put into federal civil rights law a ban on sexual orientation, gender identity discrimination without putting in protections for religious freedom. This is like a nuclear option. It would just wipe out much of the freedoms that currently are enjoyed by religious organizations, by people in their lives. One of the things it would do, in fact, is actually undermine the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a law that was passed in 1993, big majorities in the House and the Senate, signed proudly by President Clinton into law, to strengthen in federal law protections for religious exercise, religious organizations. Equality Act would say, we're going to cut away at that, so you can't appeal to religious freedom if somebody charges you with discrimination against a gay person. Right? So this law that's put in there to mirror the Constitution and protect religion strongly, Equality Act would just say, let's cut out fundamental parts of it. And, you know, it's not, it's a serious business because when the Equality Act was in the last Congress in 2018, 200 House members were co-sponsors. That's not quite half, but that's getting way up there. In the Senate, it was 47 co-sponsors. That's not half, but that's getting way up there. People who said, we're just going to protect gay rights, tough luck, religious people. So that's one of the big trends. And now Nancy Pelosi, of course, is the Speaker of the House. It's not just that, but there's been efforts since Hobby Lobby to undermine the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in other ways, and one of them almost passed the Senate. And here's something that you might find at least worrisome. One of those bills, it's now called the Do No Harm Act, which would rewrite these religious freedom protections in a way that doesn't protect a lot of religious exercise that we think is important. In 2018, it had among its sponsors, I'm going to read some names, and you think about who are these people. These are senators: Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, and Elizabeth Warren. Who are those people? They're all presidential candidates. And they all said, we want to pass a law that undermines religious freedom protections. That's how worried they are that religious people are going to do harm to other people. So that's one idea that's out there. The other one you've heard of, called the First Amendment Defense Act. It came up after the 2015 Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. And basically just says, okay, we've got First Amendment protections, let's put that into the law so it's crystal clear what it protects, what religious freedom protects. And among other things, the First Amendment Defense Act says that a person or an organization that believes in traditional marriage and that believes that sex ought to be reserved to traditional marriage cannot, for that reason, lose accreditation, tax-exempt status, government contracts, professional license, so on. That seems pretty important to me, all those things, right? You just believe something you're allowed to believe by the Constitution, and the Supreme Court says it's a perfectly legitimate belief. You shouldn't get penalized by the government. So it's a great idea, but it hasn't gone anyplace in Congress. And in fact, in the last Congress, where we had President Trump in the White House who could sign a bill like that, and he said he would, and we had a Republican Senate and a Republican House, that bill was not even introduced into the House at all. In other words, it's gotten so little traction among Republicans, they didn't even bother doing this. So to my mind, that's not a very good way to protect our religious freedom, if our friends don't even want to pursue it when they have the power. But the ideas in it, I think, are exactly right. So Fairness for All is a different strategy to get to the same place of protecting religious exercise in the change in America. One thing we say is people on the other side don't even want to talk to you if all you want to talk about is religious freedom, because they say you already have lots of protections and we have none. Why should we even talk with you? But also, it strikes us that if you want to have protections that are meaningful for religious exercise, what a Christian college does and so on, you actually have to think about it very concretely in relationship to these other rights that you're trying to protect against. Right? It's one thing to just have some principles that will protect religion, but does that mean everywhere? Does it not matter if it's in housing or a Christian college campus or a secular campus? Right? Does it make a difference? Does it make a difference if it's a religious employer or a secular employer? Does it make a difference if it's a public space that's open to everybody all the time, or one in which It's a church service, and once in a while you invite people in to do a voter drive, something like that. There's all these areas where the exact question is, what is fair, what is right, what is legitimate in all these specific things? And in the Fairness for All process, we've now been talking for 2 years about all that kind of detail to see, is it possible to get agreement about the difference between the religious employer that cares about the religion of their employees and a Christian businessman who just hires without regard to religion, right? Or the kindergarten that's run by a church compared to the one that's run by a secular entity. What needs to be protected in which case? So since mid-2016, there have been discussions going on, they're not quite at the end, between religious freedom advocates on the one side and LGBT activists who, as I said, actually believe in the First Amendment. Talking through all the different kinds of parts of life that law affects and should protect. Employment, housing, government contracts, what about marriage, and so on. One way you can think about what we've been doing is, you know, if the Equality Act started to go through the House and people were willing to say, okay, we get it, you should protect some religion at the same time, we could say, here are the things you need to do to protect religion adequately. Right? So that we've finally done the work to be able to offer that. But of course, that's not what's going to happen with the Equality Act. Once it starts moving, people are going to say, hey, we've got all the votes, we're just going to do it ourselves. So we're trying to get the jump on that by saying, there's a way to protect your rights, legitimate rights, but protect ours at the same time. Okay. So I can't tell you all the details of this process. Later in the spring, there'll be a bill that we expect to be introduced by a bipartisan set of senators and members of the House, and it will go down through all the critical kinds of details for protecting religious freedom when also gay people's rights are protected. And let me tell you what some of our goals have been in these discussions. First of all, to fully preserve the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Not let it get shrunk at all, because it's something that people depend on in court against restrictions on religious freedom. Secondly, just like with the First Amendment Defense Act, preserve the tax-exempt status and the tax-deductible gifts of religious organizations that dissent from popular views on human sexuality. All right? Third, just like the First Amendment Defense Act, that persons and organizations can't lose a license, accreditation, or be excluded from government funding because of their traditional morality. Fourth, that gender identity can't be what you dreamed up last night. But if you are serious and you have thought that your life is so far out of line that you have taken serious steps to try to change that, then that's something people have to take seriously. But not if you just wake up and say, I'd like to be in the girls' dorm or something like that. Trying to stabilize that concept. Fifth, that Christian employees in secular companies could decline to participate in activities that they find morally troubling. They have some rights at the moment, but there's been a bill that's been sitting around in Congress for a long time called the Workplace Religious Freedom Act that's never gotten any place, partly because business, Chamber of Commerce and so on don't like it. But that's a goal, to have that be part of any kind of deal, so that a Christian employee in some company could say, I get it, we're doing this as a company, but I can't take part in this myself. So let me sit this out. Sixth, that religiously guided small businesses are exempt from the new restrictions on sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. Just like, unless you have at least 15 employees, you're not even subject to federal employment law. Right? So put a threshold. Seventh, hospitals are not required to do gender transition surgery if they have religious objection to it. Eighth, religious universities, pre-K, K through 12, daycare, and so on, can maintain their biblical admissions standards, their curriculum, their conduct standards, their housing restrictions, and all the rest. Nobody has to go to those places if they don't want to be there, right? And the fact that college has those policies doesn't exclude them from funding or from accreditation. Ninth, that religious adoption agencies cannot lose their license simply because they disagree with contemporary sexual norms, and that some form of funding be worked out, kind of like vouchers, something like that, that kind of puts the parents in charge. If they want to go to an agency that only serves gay people, that's fine. If they want to go to one that helps you with Indian adoption, that's fine. If you want to go to one with traditional sexual morality, that's fine. The federal government will fund all of them. That's been one of the goals in our talk. And then, tenth, of course, there are many more parts. I'll talk about some of this tomorrow morning in two workshops. The tenth, that federally funded services, for example, homeless youth, for food banks, drug treatment, prison ministries, and so on, they have to serve everybody who's eligible. Just like right now, religious providers of services have to serve everybody, whatever their faith is. But that requirement of no discrimination based on religion, sexual orientations, gender identity, and so on, only would apply to the service the government's funding. And everything else you do, you run according to your faith tradition. Now, will all these things be in the bill? And of course, it depends on the exact language. So I get that. Now, I'm not a prophet. We don't know what's going to happen when Congress gets its hands on things. You never know. You can only start them off on what you think is the right direction. We've been talking widely with religious freedom advocates because we don't want to do anything that only helps Christian colleges, for example, and not religious colleges of other faiths, or only pastors but not business people, and so on. So we have wide consultation across religious denominations, and our gay counterparts have been talking all the time to their LGBT advocates. Some of them are names you would know that are out there agitating, and those people out there agitating say, hey, if you're not going to give us an inch, we're just going to crush you. But if we can work out a deal that works for both of us, we would entertain that. So we've been talking on both sides in this process. Now, I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned, and some of it's about details, and I can't tell you all the details because the legislation's not been introduced yet. Now I want to talk about two big picture problems with what I just proposed. And the first one is the very legitimate concern that if sexual orientation and gender identity are added to civil rights law as protected classes, then the federal government, that powerful body with a certain moral authority, is saying, if you don't go along with this agenda, you're discriminating, right? Because that's what it would say. You can't discriminate on these bases. And isn't that a dangerous thing to do? So that's a really important question. As it happens, civil rights law does two things, though. It both says some things are forbidden, and it says other things are permitted. Let me take you back to the federal civil rights law on employment discrimination. The general rule is no covered employer can discriminate based on religion when they hire and fire. But the law says that requirement doesn't apply to religious organizations. That's why Wesleyan colleges can hire only believers. It says it right in the civil rights law. It says this thing is discrimination and this other thing is not discrimination. So the details that we've been working on Fairness for All are, what are the things that the law ought to protect the kind of treatment, the kind of differences that ought to be protected, along with the things that are wrong. So would it be okay for a gay person not to be able to get credit from a bank? I think all of us would say that's crazy. Why shouldn't a gay person be able to get credit? But should a gay person be able to go to a Wesleyan university and say, you got to hire me without regard to my sexuality, no matter what your standards are? Well, I think that would be wrong for the law to require the latter, right? So fairness for all would put right into civil rights law, some things are forbidden, other things are protected. And to my mind, that's going to be, if this happens, really important for us for the future. You know, there are all those people out there, like former U.S. Civil Rights Commission Chairman Castro, who thinks that all the things you're doing every day in your universities and in your daily lives and in your churches is wrongful discrimination. Too bad the law doesn't forbid it. It would be good to be able to say back to him, but the law has actually looked at this and said it's perfectly fine for us to do these things. And why is that? Because we have to protect gay people against discrimination, but we have to protect religious exercise. That's also one thing that we're committed to as a society. And to have that right in the law, I think, would be a very great strength when regulators are making their regulations and accreditors are deciding what to do, and people are thinking about whether or not they're going to sue you in your business or your school or your religious entity. Then, so that's one issue. I think the other one, and we can talk more about this, I'm sure we will, is this issue. Isn't this the case? Human law ought to reflect what justice really is. And I don't think that gay activity is something that pleases God. So are we going to write something into the law that says this is perfectly fine? So isn't that a real challenge? So this is kind of the challenge that the reformers found, right? So we're going to get rid of the obligation to follow Catholicism. Now can we put in an obligation to follow the Wesleyan Church? Or do we have to kind of back off and say that's not something that government is going to do? We would like the law to say what we think is justice. The problem is in our society we have very different views of what justice is, what morality is, what is good for people, what is harmful. And that's where we've gotten. And you know, it's interesting to me, and it's worth thinking about, people who now are so strongly for, say, gay marriage, gender identity changes, sexual conduct that we think violates biblical norms, they came to all those things when it was illegal. The law was trying to teach them something else, and they said, no, we're going to change the law because these are the things that we believe is not what the law tells us. You know, the law is not as powerful as we would like it to be when it comes to basic morality. And then I think the question becomes, what can we entrust the law to do when we have these fundamental differences about these very important things? I think at least it's got to protect the space for you and I to keep doing what we think God asks us to and keep making our arguments to our fellow citizens that we think what you're doing, you think it's fine. We think it's damaging to you and others. We would like you to change. You know, religious freedom protects everybody's religions, but it doesn't keep us from witnessing, does it? It just protects us to be able to live in a faithful way. Well, I think that's kind of where we've gotten here. We live in this age in which Christianity, Judeo-Christian values, our basic conceptions about some very important things are not the stamp of the age. It's something else that's out there that so many of our fellow citizens, not just in Hollywood, but in our own families and churches and our neighbors, something else that they think is right. And they say the law has to protect us and not just you. What do we do in this time? How do we stand? What's a policy that gives us a place to stand so we can keep living faithfully and making our arguments? So I think it's some kind of a civic pluralism. That's what religious freedom's all about. It just says we disagree. There's some things you can do with your faith. You can teach your kids your faith. but you can't make me teach my kids your faith. Right? You can live out these parts of your faith, but you can't live out everything. We're not going to have Sharia law in the United States. That violates too many parts of our civic code that we've agreed to. But there are things you can do in our society. So civic pluralism is a way the government helps us to live together despite our deep differences. And I think that's what we have to have also when it comes to these deep moral differences that we've now ended up with. I don't think this does not require you to shut your mouth up. If you're a good neighbor, you talk to your neighbor about how they're going in the wrong direction, right? But on the other hand, they can't come over and tell you you've got to live your life differently and force that on you. So civic pluralism gives us the space to continue to witness. And that witness ought to be way out there in society, in my view. It ought to be in our voting, in our ability to run for office, despite all the pressure that's coming against us these days on Capitol Hill, running public institutions, having access to public funds, running businesses and so on, that we should be able to preach what we think is right about these things and live them out in institutions. And if it happens that the authorities say no, then like Peter and John, we say we're going to follow God anyway. We're going to find a way to do things. But I think we want to pray that we don't have to do these things underground, but that our society will actually give us space to live lives of holiness, even though other people disagree with what holiness is. I think we can pray that the law will protect our ability to live by what we are sure God calls everyone to, so we can try to convince them to turn in a different direction. So, to my mind, that's what Fairness for All will do, and that's what it attempts to do, and that's what we've been working for. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley. We're going to give you a chance to, that's a lot of information to process, and we often do a thing we call silent and solo. You introverts will love this. You're able to think for a second and jot down questions that might have arisen from what Stanley shared with us. Then I'll give you a couple minutes to talk amongst yourselves. So if you'll take 90 seconds to yourself quietly, then I'll release you to have a little bit of a more robust question conversation at your table. And we'll collect those questions while you're having that conversation. And we'll spend some time with Stanley doing some Q&A. So a lot of good questions here. Some of them are probably quicker than others. So I'm going to ask a few of these. One issue is protection for students who graduate from Christian institutions. I know in the case in Canada, there was a law school, a Christian law school, and then the bar wouldn't let them pass the bar. So our graduates, when they move out into the world, how might a Fairness for All legislation or a FATA legislation protect on that domain?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it probably depends a little bit on the domain, as it were. You know, so it's private business can basically run themselves within certain boundaries the way they want. And if they say, we just don't want to hire certain kinds of people who don't fit with our diverse workplace or something like that, they probably have a lot of scope to do that. I think what's really most important here is the kind of choke points, which are the kind of accrediting agencies like that monitor for who can be a lawyer, who can be a counselor, and all those kinds of things. And so that's a little bit too much detail for it to be in civil rights law, but there are some principles that we are trying to put into the law that would protect people who otherwise follow the professional standards, but they disagree ideologically about things like this, right? So you can't say, let me be a doctor, because you can't discriminate against me because I happen to not be, you know, all with a gay agenda, but it turns out you're also not trained as a doctor, right? Professional association can screen out those who aren't trained professionally, but they can't use that professional definition as a way of keeping you out because of your religiously based views on other things. So I think that's the kind of principle that would end in a law like this. And then other things have to be done. So the Higher Education Act, they've been working now for a number of years to strengthen that in these kinds of areas. And unfortunately, it had good language, didn't pass the last Congress. Again, I'm kind of worried about our Republican brothers and sisters in Congress who had the majority in the House and Senate and didn't pass that such important protections. So I don't know what the future is for that. But there are a lot of places that are going to have to work. One idea here is that we can create a kind of template in federal law about basic principles that then give guidance on how we would solve some of these other things. And that also applies to state law. Federal government often can't override state law, but the federal government can set up a principle of this is what it means to actually protect religious freedom, which you're required to do as a state, even while you protect other rights. So the federal government can set up a law. In the proposal that's been worked on, there actually are some preemptive elements that would tell states they've got to back off on a few things. So that's very positive. But generally speaking, states have their own areas of legislation, and the federal government can't tell them what else to do. It can set up a model, however, that we hope would be effective for guiding states.
So given that, the question is, if federal law were passed, would that prevent states from passing laws which would restrict religious freedom?
Yeah, so there's a constitution. States have their own religious freedom protections. A lot of them have their own religious freedom protection acts. So part of what Fairness for All would do is to tell courts, this is what it means to protect religious freedom in this context, right? So they just have a principle that the court can just say, we'll interpret it any way we want. But Congress is saying, this is the way these things fit together. That's the way we want you to interpret it. So I can't guarantee courts are going to do X or Y. You know that. Presidents can't guarantee that their nominees are going to do X or Y either, et cetera. So I think one of the real challenges that we face as Christian believers, for that matter as Americans, is that our courts have a lot of power, and courts don't just look at what the laws are, but they also get different ideas of what they think justice is. And their different ideas of what justice is these days often aren't very, let's call it, Judeo-Christian. And that means that even when they look at a law, they can interpret it a different way. That's a cultural phenomenon that we just have to keep confronting as believers living out in society. And when we send people to law school and so on, to help them form a different sense in the law about what justice is.
I know that part of this question is about engaging other faiths, Muslims, Jews, Hindu, et cetera, that have been part of the conversation, but how successful are you in getting the LGBT advocates to support this effort? Are a majority of them willing to compromise in, towards this direction?
Yeah, those are both great questions. It's been hard to engage all parts of the religious community. Not everyone, not all organizations, different faiths are as equally organized to deal with these kinds of questions in Washington. Some of them don't even have Washington representatives. And so that's made it challenging. However, you know, on our side and also on their side, there are constitutional law experts that work with a wide range of groups. And so they can bring in to the discussion what they know from having litigated for defending Muslims or Sikhs and so on. On the LGBT groups, you know, That's not who I am. So I've made some new friends, so that's good. We all need to figure out how we live with each other, even when you deeply disagree about many things they believe. Of course, we have to already do that based on religion, and people have gotten divorced multiple times, and their political opinions are so screwy. I won't tell you what those are. So I've made some new friends, and that's been very interesting. The LGBT advocates we've been working with, who carry a lot of heft, partly because of the money they have behind them and the electoral role they play behind the scenes. It's been interesting in some of our discussions in which we've said you have to put this language in there, otherwise you will not be protecting religious freedom. And sometimes they've said to us, no, we have to put that language in there because otherwise you're going to let government get too big. And we're conservatives, and we don't want government to get too big. I bet you didn't expect to hear that from LGBT advocates. All right, so it's been really interesting to listen to them and be part of this discussion over 2.5 years, often face-to-face, sometimes in retreats, sometimes in thousands of emails and phone calls and so on. I was actually with some of our LGBT allies when on Capitol Hill this thing called the Kavanaugh hearings went on. You remember that? And what were all the airwaves filled with was how evil this person was, probably a drunkard, sexual pervert, abused women, and you got to get him out of there. And I sat in this national conference of this gay group, and they had a panel on the Kavanaugh hearings, and nobody said a single thing about any of that. They said, we like his judicial philosophy. I was shocked. They said, you know, there are judges you can get to change their view. Like, there's a lot of effort going on to get judges to say that when the law says no sex discrimination, that includes sexual orientation and gender identity. And they said, we're not very happy with that strategy. What happens then when we put something else in the law that we think is protecting us, and some judge comes along and says, hey, I'm going to reinterpret that some other way? They said, we would rather have the judges read what the law says and follow it. They said, we think Kavanaugh will do that, so let's pass a good law in Congress and you'll enforce it and it'll be good for gay people and religious people. I was blown away, I'll tell you. So now, they've been talking all the time with their allies, and there are all kinds of them, Lambda Legal and the ACLU and Human Rights Campaign and so on. Some of them, they say, are never going to agree to anything like this, partly because they make their money from controversy, right? And partly because they just have a different view, and some of the people are just against Christians and don't want to give you any space and so on. But he said, we've talked to a lot of people in detail. We've run proposed language past them because they work with young people, because they work with adopted kids and so on. And they feel, now I don't see a lot of discrimination, but they feel very vulnerable. And so they're looking at it, and they would like to see some legislation that actually practically protects them. And if other people want to specialize in yelling to raise funds, that's kind of their business. But they would like to see something actually happen in legislation. So they've been chopping that around to a lot of groups. They're pretty confident that there will be a lot of support for it. But we'll have to see. And, you know, one thing that's going to happen when whatever the legislation is comes out, there'll be a lot of efforts to say, but it doesn't do this, it doesn't do that, and that's going to happen on all sides, and we don't know what the consequence of. So we have been doing this as an act of faith. That's what it is. It's an investment. We don't know if it's going to go anyplace. We don't know if Congress will take it up. We don't know if the president would sign it. But all we can do is put the best thing that we can come up with out there and give people a chance to say, this is better than continuing to just go our separate ways, because eventually we do have to live together. So this is our best shot at this. I worked on something like this back in the late 90s that had to do with religious organizations getting public funds. When we started working on that idea, a lot of our religious allies didn't like it. A lot of our secular opponents said this will never go anyplace. But miracle of miracles, it ended up in the federal welfare law. And it became the basis on which the federal faith-based initiative became a reality under President Bush, continued under President Obama, continued under President Trump. And so something that at the time was just, as it were, speculative, we just thought it was a good, important idea to protect the ability of faith organizations to serve the public with government dollars without giving up their religious character. It turned out to be the idea that was needed. But, you know, you can't make that up at the last minute. You got to have it ready, and then you hope people are ready for it.
Along those lines of being prepared and an idea that preserves religious freedom of the organization but lets them have access to federal funds going forward, so that's a case where that exact dynamic, even though the controversy at the time, works, right?
It worked.
How about, how's it going in Utah?
Yeah. So, I'm not a Utahan, but I've been there. I spoke at Brigham Young University Law School, and I did it pretty recently, so they actually had a coffee machine back there for the non-Mormons who were speaking at their conference. So that was really, I was happy about that. It's a pretty strict faith. All the, many of the lawyers we've worked on in this process were part of the thing in Utah, and they said it's been really important in Utah to keep the mounting tensions that were growing from happening. And so lawsuits that had been launched before, they've been taken away because people feel pretty well protected. Now, United States is bigger. It's not going to solve everybody's problem, and there are a lot of people who aren't going to like one thing or the other, and they're going to challenge this or that. That's just kind of reality. I think what we've been trying to aim for is not a log rolling compromise. You know what those are? It's kind of like, you know, you give me this. I know that really hurts you a lot, but I'm going to give you this because that really hurts me a lot. And if our pain is equal, then we can agree on the deal. We've tried to say, are there places where something that we think is good, you can accept because it doesn't hurt you, right? And there's something that you really want that we can accept. It's not what we do on our own, but it's not going to hurt us if we do that. I don't really think that a landlord should kick somebody out just because they're gay. But I think Christian College Housing ought to be able to say we have some conduct standards for our housing. To me, those are two separate things. And they've said, yeah, we see that those are two separate things. So we tried to find all those places where we can agree on what's fair. And some of that's taken a lot of time, and we haven't agreed on everything, that's for sure.
From your experience with those conversations, just in general, as being able to assess the political landscape, and which is risky, you said you don't like to do that. But someone's asked, does the FFA have a reasonable chance of actually becoming law?
Yeah, it does have a reasonable chance of becoming law. Boy, that's, ask God. You know, Congress has made almost no laws over the last number of years. I mean,
so
that's
is
just
a reasonable chance of a law being made is the first question.
Yeah, that's like one of the questions.
Yeah.
But you know, there are lots of reasons for that, and you know, we all need to pray for our country. We need to pray for legislators, Christian and not, that they kind of figure out a way to work together, because there are things that the government ought to decide on. And I was really struck by talking with Republican staff members of a Republican committee before this last election about 4 years ago in the House education workforce, and she and her Republican colleagues told us that committee was not able to pass legislation they thought was really important, because although it was a Republican committee, Democrats would put onto every bill some pro-gay language, and the Republicans, despite having a majority and this being their committee, could not take it off. In other words, there were Republicans who were so committed to the gay cause on that committee that they just said, we're just going to stall things out. So that committee just has felt like for a number of years, they've not in their committee been able to do anything. And then I talked to a Senate committee, staffers for a Senate committee last year, and they said the same thing. There are child welfare changes that really need to be made for the sake of children and foster care and adoption, but we can't make them. Because as soon as we try to advance a bill, the LGBT side puts a language in there that says that every organization out there has to, you know, send kids out for adoption without regard to same-sex marriage and so on. And the Republicans, when they get a chance, put something on the bill that says, no, we ought to be allowed to do whatever we want, and it just stalls out their action. So really, this has been one of the things that stalled and polarized Congress. So would some legislators say, this is something we could move ahead on and we think it's a good idea? I'm not going to predict. But like I said, these things you can't make up at the last minute. So all we can do is construct it, try to be sensitive, listen to all the critics that we hear, and then have it available. And it'll get launched in the spring, and then we'll see what happens.
I think your reference to the log rolling compromise might have addressed this, but are there things that understand we're wanting to, says, well, I understand we're wanting to take care of us, what are we giving up to this? In other words, are there things that are specific that one side is saying, we'll give this up, the other side is saying, we'll give this up, versus saying, these are the things we want, are they okay with you? These are the things we want, are they okay with
you? Yeah, I think, to my mind, the two most difficult areas, one of them is just having more government regulation. We got so much already. And the problem is the federal government is way off there in Washington, and it doesn't understand everything that's happening around the country. And so have more power for law enforcers is a problem. I think, however, it's not a question of will we have more regulation or not, but will that regulation protect religion as well as gay people? So we just decided we have to kind of be there and work on what the principles are going to be. So that's really hard. I think the other area is that our society, and this is terrible, we need to keep working at this, does not want, and our laws basically do not want to protect people who are out in commercial enterprise, or hardly at all to protect them if they have distinctive religious views. And I think that's tragic. You know, the court stepped up with Hobby Lobby and protected the Green family. So it's willing to do it sometimes, but it's not always willing to do it. And you remember the Supreme Court in the Masterpiece Cake decision didn't say, of course, Jack has a right to say, this is my business, I'm going to do one thing and not another thing. They just said, Colorado can't be so biased against religious people, but have to give them a fair shake. But the court did not say what a fair shake is. They did say, we've got to respect religion, we've got to respect gay rights. What does that mean in commercial enterprise? I think there ought to be a lot of freedom in the marketplace for people to do things in varied ways. That's what a marketplace is. And if you don't like the way somebody serves you, go to somebody else, right? But our law does not protect religion very well in the marketplace. And so it's going to be hard, whether it's fairness for all. FATA actually just said, hey, if it's a big publicly traded company, no protections at all. That's kind of how hard it is in law. But we at least said we're going to protect the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. No dilution, so you can still make your case.
Everyone, since you mentioned the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, how risky is it just to try to defend that?
Well, we can, and so we have and are defending the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and that's so fundamental. But you know what? If your religious freedom rests just on that law, then what happens is the bureaucrats, first of all, violate your religious freedom, and now you can go to court and get it upheld. But in the meantime, it's been violated, right? Legislation, though, can say what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act means is that if you're a religious college, you can have your religious standards for what students you admit, what you allow them to do, and so on, and you don't have to wait until the litigators get busy 10 years down the road. Right? It creates a certainty because it spells out what ought to happen. So we have to keep the Religious Freedom Restoration Act strong, but I think we need this other kind of detail at the same time. And one of the lawyers we've been working with, actually for Brigham Young University, he said he spends almost all his time not thinking about what Congress is doing, but thinking about what the bureaucrats are doing. And he would like to have some guidance to those bureaucrats that's something a little bit more detailed than the First Amendment or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that says you cannot let that accreditor take away their accreditation because of their Christian standards, you know, whatever.
I'm just going to read this question, and forgive me, Canadian, we're not going to unleash you on the room on this, but it's something for us to think about and maybe another time find someone that does similar things in Canada. But just what would our Canadian brothers and sisters in the room say regarding protection, since they don't have those protections anymore? So we need to remember that Kingswood comrades are living without these kinds of protections. They have some unique challenges and other cases up there that make it potentially more risky for them. But obviously the point of these different possibilities are to preserve some of those protections. So if you follow Canadian dynamics, that might be a canary in the mine for those of us that are south of the border about the things we may face if we don't secure appropriate protections and strengthen.
So just one thing on that. So I work with a Canadian think tank, and Cartus. And, of course, so I've paid some attention to two recent developments in Canada. One of them is Trinity Western University that tried to open a law school. And, you know, 20 years before, the Canadian Supreme Court, interpreting exact same language, protected Trinity Western's teacher training program that basically was charged exactly the same way as being discriminatory. And this time they refused to protect them when it came to the law school. And so Trinity Western basically decided, if we're going to have a law school, we have to make our community covenant voluntary. In other words, they had to give in to the government. And, you know, one of the differences between the two countries is that we do have very stronger religious freedom protections here than they have in Canada. But the thing that's common between the two countries is a public sentiment that really despises Christians who don't go along with the gay agenda. And in Canada, they have not very strong religious freedom protections that allow you to say, sorry, I know you don't like what we're doing, but it's still protected. We have laws and principles and constitutional principles that protect us, but we have to make sure that people don't get so convinced that we're against them that they find ways to override those protections. So that's one thing. The other thing you may have heard about is in Canada, for many years, there's been the so-called Canada Jobs Program, in which businesses, churches, all kinds of organizations have been able during the summer to get small grants from the federal government to hire somebody to work with them. So the student gets some experience, they get some money for their education. And last year, with the new Liberal government, very progressive, the Canada Grants Program said, sure, you could take part in this grants program, whatever organization you are, but you got to go along with our progressive agenda about abortion. And if you can't assent to that, you can't get these grants. And it didn't matter if your organization had nothing to do with abortion or anything else. It's just kind of like you're not a good enough person if you don't go along with the abortion agenda. So there were a lot of court cases, a lot of actually sympathy in Canada for churches and mosques and others who just said, we can't sign this. So that requirement of agreeing has now been changed a little bit, but it's not been changed very much. So one of the problems in Canada is that they've now slipped into this kind of mode of, you know, unless you're thinking the right kind of way, the government doesn't even want to think it has to do anything with you. So it's not even that you've actually done something that somebody considers discriminatory. It's just that you're the kind of person or organization that has the kind of views they don't like. And then they're trying to push you into the margins of society. We want to keep that from happening one way or another. And we have better principles to do that, but I think we have to get on top of some of these trends and not let them just proceed.
Okay, this is a last question. You started with some kind of doctrinal historical perspectives, and so we'll end with a little loop by that area again. The Western Church has clear doctrinal statements about marriage and sexuality officially approved and nearly unanimously, and they are affirmed by we five leaders, our presidents and board chairs, and everybody in this room. But the Western Church has no official strategy statements related to things like Fairness for All or FATA. Obviously, we wouldn't go for the Equality Act. That are officially approved. But on the strategy, there's differences. There's differences between We Five schools, differences between people that are Wesleyan. What advice would you give to those who agree doctrinally at the kind of fundamental and highest level too, yet disagree strategically, and how might we as Wesleyans agree to disagree regarding strategy?
Yeah. Hey, I'm not a Wesleyan. I don't have to solve this for you. No, sorry about that. So it's a hard question. So one thing that we've done on the Fairness for All is to watch and listen and learn from everything that people have been trying to do with FATA. Because everything that's in there is things that we want to protect. But then also watching the fact that Republicans don't even want to push it forward, despite all the pressure they've gotten from Heritage Foundation and Family Research Council and everybody else. It's just kind of sitting there, and here you've got this majority in the House and the Senate. People have been saying this for years. You know a crisis is coming, Republicans. Why don't you give it a hearing? Why don't you pass it? So in the first place, I think, to my mind, the Fairness for All strategy and the FATA are trying to get to the same place, We're trying to figure out how do we live faithfully, appeal to our neighbors to protect our right to live by our faith in our change in America. So we're trying to do that. So in the first place is, what are all the places we can work together and learn from each other? Secondly, to not make this more ultimate than it is. It is a political strategy, and it's, you heard me say, I think Fairness for All is a good idea. I don't know if it's going to pass, right? We don't know that. That's not under my control. Back when I first started thinking about Christian politics, I heard a Reformed theologian say, you know, the worst thing about America is it's a democracy. If we had a dictatorship, we just find a good Calvinist to be our dictator, and then everything would be fine. But that's not the kind of country we live in, and you probably wouldn't want the Calvinist to be the dictator anyway. So we live in a democracy. So what we've tried to do is to do something that we think is responsible. Listen to Ryan Anderson, Heritage Foundation, Family Research Council, FATA proponents. What could we learn from them? Every article that comes out, have we protected that adequately? Are we mistaken here? And to do all that. And then just say, these are prudential judgments. Just like another hard area of how to protect life, you know, unborn life. That's a really hard question. And for a long time, people said, the only thing you can do is demand reversal of Roe and a constitutional amendment. And anything else just legitimates abortion. So if you do things like 20-week waiting period, or if you do something like parental, you know, notices required, or controlling clinics or whatever, isn't that just giving in to say, well, abortion's fine if you do those things? So there are huge debates in the pro-life community. And finally, people said, well, let's do what we can do and then keep telling the public, it is, look what picture you put up on your refrigerator. How can you just say this is a nothing? So how can we keep advancing the law? So what we'd like to do here is, this is a prudential judgment. Hopefully Congress will say yes, it'll have very strong protections, give us beachheads from continuing to argue in favor of biblical morality.
Thank you for casting a lot of light on an area that often has heat. We appreciate the tireless efforts you put into tracking, following, discussing, emailing, meeting with folks to be able to bring something positive to pass, and we'll be praying for you. And we will also be thanking you out loud for your work. Let's thank you.